Welcome to another episode of Chef Journeys. Today, I've got Jensen Cummings. Boy, you want to talk about somebody who has transcended the chef role. I am so excited for this one. Jensen, thank you for coming to play with us.
I'm so happy to be here, Simon. Appreciate you.
Awesome. You know, let's just jump on this sucker. Tell us how you got into this business, because I'm sure there's a lot to it.
There's been a long and winding road. My story, my journey actually starts long, long before I was even born. I'm the fifth consecutive generation of chef restaurateur in our family. We opened our first restaurant in 1900 in Little Falls, Minnesota, a place called La Fond House. I've only seen pictures of it. It looks like one of those saloons where Wyatt Earp would have shot somebody out front, right? Nice. Like that kind of style. No menu. They served like a dish, whatever the dish was, that's what you had, whatever pot was going at the time. And that was great, great grandparents. Then great grandparents and grandparents were restaurateurs and barmen in San Francisco. And my dad's three younger brothers all own restaurants across three different states. So it's in my blood. Even my younger brother is also a chef. So it's always been kind of in my blood. One of the things I talk about what that meant for me was, I wasn't smart enough to get a real job, and I was never asked, when are you going to get a real job? Something I think a lot of us transient folks in the industry, you know, coming in at 17, a lot of us get into the restaurant industry. Nobody becomes an investment banker at 17. And so the trajectory is very different. I know we'll get into a lot of that. And that was kind of something that stuck with me early on. And that's where the story really starts. And then when I graduated high school, went and worked for my uncles out in Ames, Iowa, went from San Diego to Ames, Iowa, major culture shock, 17-year-old kid. Thought I was just going to have a summer job going, washing dishes and chasing college girls, and ended up being out there for 5+ years, culinary school and da-da-da-da-da. And I was on my way.
Awesome. So, I mean, I think as many chefs as I can think of that I talk to, we all have something in common. It's like we all get in it. And then something, clearly it was in your blood just like at birth. But like, what kept you around? Like, what made you go, gosh, this is, I mean, what, at some point there's choice, but maybe there isn't. So what kept you?
You know, I was a punk kid, such a troublemaker. And when I mentioned I graduated high school, barely, I got kicked out of a couple of schools, all that. My uncle, cool uncle. I'm going to talk about cool uncle later. Just remember that. Earmark, cool uncle. My cool uncle is Uncle Rick, a.k.a. Rico Suave, a.k.a. the coolest guy in the room. He says, hey, kid, get your ass out here. Come work for me for the summer. Lived in his garage for about a month. And then it's kind of like you find your people, right? Mm-hmm. I tell myself that I was smarter than the cool kids and cooler than the smart kids. The reality was I wasn't as cool as the cool kids, and I wasn't as smart as the smart kids, right? You have to lie to yourself to survive sometimes when you're young. And there was this mix of that where you had to have talent. You had to be able to do 500 covers. You had to be able to handle that pressure. And also you got to like live in it. I didn't want the cubicle, the 9-to-5, the suit and tie, all of those things weren't for me. And so the fact that I could see something that was really challenging, I could be great at it, was one part of it. And then finding your people, I lived in a house in a college town with four other dudes that I worked with at the restaurant. And it was work hard, play hard when you're a 17-year-old kid. Like that's what I thought I was really looking for. So that really got me into it, where I felt like I had that camaraderie that maybe I was missing to a degree through my life up to that point. And that created the foundation where there was a little bit of interdependence, a little bit of enabling that kept us in that space for probably too long, right? We're in our adolescence and we don't want to leave it. And there's a lot to the industry of how we don't take ourselves and each other seriously as true professionals. So we stay in that space. We're kind of like a 17-year-old kid until we're 40 and burned out. We go, what the fuck happened? So there was a lot of that. Amen. And then, then I went to culinary school and I got kind of more on the professional track and wanted to like really take it seriously. Hospitality, restaurant management, some of those things. My trajectory was very, very steep. I think about Kim Smith's book, Radical Candor. She talks about rock stars and superstars, yeah, right? Rock stars are the ones that are the bedrock. They show up exactly on time. They do their job better than anybody, but they don't want to be the chef, right?
Right.
Unfortunately, we too often put them in a managerial role and then they struggle and fail and then they're on the way out. They should have stayed a rock star. Superstars have that steep trajectory that kind of want your job. And so I was definitely on that one, from dishwasher to running a kitchen in like a year and a half. And wow. I've always kind of ascended in that way, just because I'm going to, you know, outwork, out hustle, Mamba mentality, whatever it was. And that steep trajectory means you also burn out quicker than most.
Yeah, there's a lot of fire that it takes to get going that way.
You know,
I feel it. I think that I probably was somewhere in the middle of those two archetypes, right? Like I it wasn't steep for me, but boy, I pushed hard, yeah, right? Yeah. When, you know, so I feel you, man. Like, I think the culinary school thing is important. I when you were talking about the enabling and the, yeah, I just think of that as like those, that stuff is so much fun. I remember
it's
those
too
days.
Much fun.
Totally. Right? Totally. I remember looking at my folks going, man, I need to chill out for a little while.
Like, hell are we doing here?
Yeah. Like, oof. Well, awesome. You know, I burnout's one of those things that I think I talk about a whole lot. It definitely has hit me in the past, but like, I think it's important for us to ask ourselves how you kind of get past the burnout. Mm-hmm. And then once you do that, like, what was the corner that turned for you? Like, you now are, I mean, let's see, you got 4 hospitality focused businesses, right? Like, you got merch.
We're glutton for punishment, Simon, clearly.
That's awesome. Hell yeah. Sign me up. Clearly. But like, what was the corner that like made you go, I can stay right where I am, or I can just kind of keep burning it hard?
Yeah.
Or shifting gears. Like, what was that thing?
I remember the exact day, okay, where there was an instant shift in me. It was every possible emotion I think you can go through as a human, as a man, as a chef. And so I'll take you back to that night. I did a pop-up event with a group of chefs, and I think like 50, 60, 70 people, something like that, small, but we did a big multi-course, super right, hyped up, all of that. So we're doing this dinner, and that's like the epitome for me, to do something hyper creative, something collaborative, something that pushes the envelope, is what I've always been known for throughout my career, kind of being fearless and stupid, but mostly hopefully fearless. And kind of on that vanguard. So it's just doing unique, interesting stuff, all that. Everyone's patting me on the back. Oh, you're so pretty. All of those emotions of the vanity, right? And the validation that I think, wow, a lot of us seek out. And me more than most in those moments, I definitely recognize that I needed that validation so deeply, not just at the surface level that I was a good chef, but that I was a capable and worthy human. Right. And okay, so there's something deep seated, sometimes some pain, some trauma, some of the hope that we have as well. And it kind of all gets intermingled. So I think a lot of chefs are going to understand that moment. You're just feeling it and everyone's feeling you. So I had that moment. And of course, people are buying us drinks. We're having a good time. All of that. On my way home, get pulled over, roadside sobriety check. And I'm scared, oh, wow, shitless. And I think too many of us have been in that situation. How many chefs have 1, 2, 3 DUIs on their record? That would have been my first. Somehow I passed. And the police officer was like, look, I know that you know that I know. And I was like, yes, chef. I'll get home directly and safely. And it was one of those moments. And I had a pretty tumultuous relationship with the police and authorities, being that troublemaker kid in the past. So I just was not expecting that. And the fact that that police officer kind of saved my life in that moment was pretty powerful. And it stuck with me. I get home, whew, deep, deep breath. Holy yep, shit. So I'm from the high to the low to the whew. I barely survived. And I look there on the kitchen counter, and this is late now, there's a pregnancy test that says we're about to have a kid.
Oh.
And that moment, I was like, I can't do that anymore. All of the things that I experienced in that day, the highs and the lows, I can't, and none of them are good for me, and none of them are going to be good for that kid. And that was the end of the summer 2013. And it was that night I knew I had to do something different. And from there, it's been winding, figuring out what exactly that means. But that was the moment. That was the exact night that I knew I couldn't be the chef owner, the hot shit, rising star chef, all of those things that I thought were what made me who I was.
Wow. Ooh, all right.
I got chills Woo. Thinking about that now. Every time I tell that story.
Yeah. No, I feel it. God. I love those moments in life because they're things to savor, and those are the moments where you go, okay, so now what?
Mm-hmm. So I'm here now.
Yeah. Yeah.
Now where am I going?
Yep. Yep. I mean, I had a similar moment ish, a couple years ago, and I am so thankful that like it hurt, but I had to, I burnt myself out again. So I get it. So how does that shift in gears, tell me about now, tell me about what it has become, because this is fascinating. This is the moment for the youngsters in the crowd to listen go, up. We don't have to just be shackled to the stove cooking chicken.
Yeah. So there was a couple steps, and I think some of your audience, they'll have experienced this or be at kind of that moment, that decision, that precipice moment for themselves. Said, okay, I got to get out of the restaurant. Right. I can't do the 70-hour work weeks anymore. And I was that dude. Like, there was an almost 7-year span where I didn't take one single sick day for 7 years. I thought I was being the shiny example of what to do. The reality was I was as sick as a dog so many times, like, standing up, throwing up in trash cans, like in between services. But I had to be that tough guy, tough gal mentality that we say is what you need in this industry. And I was still going to work 70 hours. I was still going to work, 40 straight days when we open a new restaurant, never take a day off. That's what it took to be that passionate, that dedicated. And the reality was I was setting a really bad example. People are like, this guy is suffering. I don't want that. Right? Okay. That's not what looks like a well-balanced life. And so I had to come to terms with that, said, okay, I got to get out of that situation. I can't be that anymore. So I got into some consulting projects. I had done some one-off consulting stuff here and there. I was like, okay, I'm going to do some consulting. That was rewarding in the sense that I was able to make a lot more money in a shorter period of time, pick my projects, things like that. I had to do a lot of broken restaurants and go and fix them. The consulting work we do now as a company is all new concept development because I'd rather try and get it right the first time. But those were those kind of early days for me. But there was also this, once you become a consultant, you're irrelevant. And I still had some ego. Still to this day, I'm like, how do I feed that desire I have to do interesting, unique, dynamic things and have an impact on the industry? So there was a few different things. I had a company called Brood Food. We did really unique food fermentation stuff. We did a whole bunch of collaborations with craft brewers. And so we got to do some really unique, 112 different variations of soy sauce using yeast and bacteria from the craft brewing process, like crazy shit like that. So I was like, okay, I'm doing cool stuff. Traveled around the country, got to do chef dinners and collaboration beers all over the country and got to do that. So I was still trying to like live in two worlds, which can be pretty challenging.
Yeah.
So did that for a while and kind of moved through that. Was a very solopreneur for a long time. We had a nonprofit. We have an event production company now, and we started that about 2013 as well. My wife works exclusively kind of on that company, so we get to do some fun stuff there. And then, I just realized I needed to have kind of diversify the different offerings that I had so I could work more deeply on the projects that I have. So we have the strategy consulting company, again, new concept development. We do some things for larger companies when it comes to especially hiring, retaining employees. We've gotten pretty good at understanding what makes a good team and culture. We have the event production. So we do a lot of stuff with nonprofits, especially that work with food access, early childhood development, education, awesome. Things like that we're really passionate about. So we'll have events. We just had an event for Invest in Kids where 20 chefs came in and one night raised $450,000. Right. To help Colorado families in need. So things like that are still really fulfilling kind of on that community side of things. The media and marketing, I had no idea we would be podcasters when we were, you know, coming up as chefs, and we'll talk about that a little bit more. And then I really like design and clever saying, so why can't we all just get ramen? You know, so we have a t-shirt design company as well. We had done some of that. We had done some design work for some of our clients. And I was like, oh, well, I'll just start a print on demand company. Why not start another business? So we do those as well. So that's the four entities that we have. But yeah, media marketing, who would have thought, Simon, that we'd be out here on the interwebs making podcasts, huh?
You know, I never really thought about this kind of stuff. I freaking love it.
Love.
Like, I just find myself reading and watching and looking and going, well, that's interesting. And you can do this and you can do that. And I dare say my wife might be getting tired of it, but because I'm just like, blah, 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 blah. But, you know, it's great. It's super inspiring because there was a point in my career, and I can't help but think of how many guys and gals I know. But there was a point in my career where I was like, I'm just a chef, right? You know, that's all I know how to do. And it's like, well, actually, yeah, we deal with right. people and how people interact with each other. And like, you know, come to find out after 30 something years in the industry for myself, I'm actually a good gauge of people. Right. Yeah, like and so I just love hearing someone that has been in the kitchen and has done all kinds of things saying, oh, marketing, I think, and you know, and the media, I think it's great stuff. I don't know, for you, what is the thing that like is most interesting about the media thing, you know, kind of almost as not necessarily former chef, but as somebody who comes from that mold, like what is it, what are those things that pull at you on the media side?
And you're right, former chef. It took me a long time. My handles were all at Chef Jensen Cummings. Last year, I dropped the chef.
Okay.
And that was like such a hard thing to do because it was such a part of my identity. And that moment actually came with a really great friend of mine, one of the chefs who established the Denver food scene, who we lost this past year, Matt Selby. And he also, around the same time, we were kind of both doing some consulting projects. One time we're sitting down, he's like, you keep beating me out on these consulting projects. So we bid on the same like three projects at one point. We were in a lot of the same circles. And he's like, what are you doing differently? I was like, look, I only got to this moment maybe a couple months ago where I had to shift my paradigm. I was a chef who was a consultant, and I had to shift to a consultant who had been a chef.
Wow.
And just changing the way that we approach everything. Because of that tough guy, tough gal mentality, we're going to overcome every shortcoming, every challenge that our menu, that our supply chain, that our design, that our dining room has put forth for us. When you're creating something, especially that new concept stuff for somebody else, it has to be built for them, not for you. And sometimes they're a tenth of a degree difference that makes all the difference. I remember my mom told me, she's of the generation that watched the moon landing live and had told me since I was a kid that you get to the moon by 10,000 adjustments of 0.00000001%. I was like, I got it. Huh. So a lot of times it's just these little things that make a difference. So I remember that. Now, that's former chef. Long story to not even your question, but especially as far as media, the first thing that really struck me was how natural it came to me.
Okay.
And I think that's part of what we don't give ourselves credit for as chefs. We are storytellers, plain and simple. Right. We have just chosen to use food, beverage, hospitality as the medium for which we tell stories, for which we connect people. And that's what media is. We were just using pots, pans, knives, a stove, and a window and a pass to be able to bring that to life.
Right.
And now we're using webcams and, you know, podcast equipment and StreamYard and Facebook and LinkedIn, whatever it might be. And that was the thing that was the most surprising to me. And so I talked to a lot of chefs, a lot of entrepreneurs, a lot of people who were kind of similar to us, where we have that hustle that kind of really propels us, that we want to create something on our own, something unique, something that makes an impact. Is you are already a media entity. You're already a media personality. You just get caught up in the fact that I don't really like social media. That's not what it's about.
Right.
It's about being a storyteller and finding all the ways and platforms and mediums for which you can tell those stories. That was the number one most surprising thing to me. Continues to surprise me to this day as we scale up. And I've produced over 500 podcast shows and done series for collaborations with all kinds of different partners and sponsors and clients. And now we're actually starting to do podcasts even outside of the restaurant industry. And, you know, you kind of have this imposter syndrome thing. You're like, well, I can't do media. I'm a chef. Bullshit. You totally can. Well, I can't do media outside of the restaurant industry. Restaurant industry is all I know. No, you know, people, you know, story, you know, how to engage, you know, what it takes to get something meaningful out in the world. You can pick different arenas to play that game, to flex those skills.
Man, I love it. You said a word somewhere in the middle of that is one of those that I love and hate, and it's the word hustle. Yep. So my question for you
said grind right after that, because that's the one that I hate the most, which is exactly the same as hustle, but I've decided grind is the dirty word. I'm with you. Let's talk about it.
Well, so the question on hustle is, do you experience, like, for me, I'm used to a certain pace as a chef, right? I worked for some pretty rough restaurant companies over the years where the pace and the grind was everything. And it's like, now I'm having to, like, come down to this space where not everybody hustles like that. Tell me about that for you, because it's different, right? Like the rest of the world, like, you can't, the joke in my family is you can't run a restaurant like that, right? So how has that, you know, how has that been for you?
Yeah, I mean, the hustle, the grind, all those things, we have a difficult relationship with those words, but more so what spawns from those words. Again, the 7 years of never taking a sick day, that was that pure grind. I will not allow myself to be less than. And it's problematic. I talk about in kind of a longer context about how I no longer believe in hard work. I now believe in being a high contributor.
Wow.
And there's a difference in that. I want to be one of the highest contributors at all times to all people that I interact with in all things that I do. That I don't need to work 70 hours to prove that I'm that.
Right.
Because that was the only metric that we have. And we're so much stuck in that because we get paid hourly. Right. So it's one of the first things when I teach people about consulting, people ask me all the time, I was like, get away from hourly as quickly as possible. It's going to change your mindset from this cut and control to this kind of growth and abundance mindset. And so we're stuck in that hustle because we're only as good as our next plate up. Smile is part of uniform. Leave your shit at the door. All these tropes that we perpetuate mean that we're only as good as the hustle, the grind, the things that we make with our hands. That's it. We have no exponential value. We can only have incremental growth and value. And that to me is short-sighted and a place that we get stuck in with this idea of hustle, with this idea of grind. I don't mind the words as much. It's the context in which we apply them and the approach and the lifestyle that kind of gives us. So yeah, I'm with you. And sometimes I use those words exactly to elicit some kind of emotion out of people because we're stuck there. We're so glorifying a lot of those things. We glorify living in a house with four dudes and eating top ramen with an egg on it because we're so poor and we hustle so hard. That's not a good way to live. That's just how we got to this point, despite all of the abuse, self-afflicted and externally afflicted, from the type of places you mentioned working at. So when we point at kids these days in big fucking air quotes and say they're the problem, they're not as committed, they don't work as hard. The reality of that is we didn't want the suit and tie, the 9-to-5, the cubicle, all of those things.
Right.
Right. We found our people. We went from being the misfits, Bourdain's pirates on the pirate ship. All of a sudden, from the Food Network effect, we went to being the cool kids. I mentioned that dinner where everyone's praise, praise, praise. It had gotten so bad to the point where all of the media that was telling you how good you were, how pretty you were, we were getting invited to, you know, sit in the Avalanche players sections at games and Nuggets games and Broncos games. Like, we were interacting with actors and these things because all of a sudden we were cool. Well, I and a lot of us did not know how to handle that. We handled it badly. It right. went to our heads. It affected so many parts of the culture, but also the business model. That's a whole nother thing. We can talk about how the chef-driven restaurant broke the fine dining, progressive dining restaurant model. We broke it from that chef-driven. It had a huge impact on the culture, but also on the economics. And so that's something that we have to grapple with. We went to being the cool kids. Now, Simon, we're the establishment. Restaurants have been outed as not a great place to work.
Yeah.
And now we're blaming kids these days, a 22-year-old, for the status quo of an industry that we built. And we're trying to say it's their fault and wondering why the hell they're lazy and don't want to work at our restaurants. The reality is we're the suit and tie now. And they're going, I don't want that life. I don't want to work there. Why would I want to get plates thrown on my head when I go flip shit on eBay and make 3 times as much money? Go fuck yourself, chef.
Yeah. It's funny. I've never thought of the idea that we're the establishment is huge. I think that one really resonates with me. The funny part is that I was talking to a chef recently, and we're talking about those kids and, you know, blah, blah, blah. And I said, hey, man, like, just because they have an idea, like, they're not wrong, first of all. He's like, yeah, I know. You know, this guy's in the middle of his second divorce, right? And he's like, I know, but what else are we supposed to do? I'm like, we got to evolve. Things have to change, man. You know, like, for a while I said, we know what the grind is. So if you're going to hustle, just hustle with care. And that was my hashtag for the last like 2 years, like hustle with care. Cause we know that it's like, until there are viable solutions and different models that are coming around, and for better or for worse, I'm not sure about Denver, but I'm starting to see more and more counter service, you know. QSRs are just booming right now. And you talk to the restaurateurs and they're like, I can't make any money with all that staff on. Right. Yeah. So the models have to change. And I think that we're about to see some crazy stuff happen, you know. But yeah, it's amazing to think that all those things that we accepted, they're not accepting. And
right.
I'm always stuck in the middle because they're right. Right, like the seven years with no sick days. I think mine was like 3 sick days in 15 years, and it was, you know. And when I actually got sick enough to keep me home for a week, my wife looked at me and was like, "We're not doing this anymore. Like, you're staying home. You can't get out of bed." I'm like, "No, I'll be fine. I'm going." And of course, I got out of bed and fell. Yeah, awesome, great. But it's those are some unhealthy things.
I'll raid the Tylenol and the first aid kit and be fine. Always the first thing to go when you restock that first aid kit. Boom, there goes all the Tylenol, ibuprofen, whatever. Because you're going through a lot of pain.
Yeah.
Physically, mentally, emotionally, for sure. And the model does have to change, right? That's where a lot of the work that we're doing, as I mentioned, kind of on the employee life cycle side of things. We have what we call workplaces worth working. Like, how do we develop a different model? We even have some interesting stuff where we have like draft boards of being like, okay, based on pay, here's all the different things that you can do as far as benefits. We break down benefits, culture, education on top of wages, which I think is important. And then it's almost like spitting out an algorithmic score that says, the amount of investment you're making into your people means you are employer of choice at kind of this level in comparison to your competition. We also had to restructure a restaurant operating budget. The same bullshit one we all copied from restaurantowner.com in 2003. It turns out that thing fucking sucks and doesn't actually work for the business model at hand today. So we restructured it so that you could actually look at how you're investing in your people and what the impacts are, what the impact of churn and turnover rate, which is at 75% plus right now, you know, right. And it's ridiculous. And I hear this from hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of owners and chefs and employers hiring managers. So I do what I do. I ask questions. I get curious about things. I'm like a dog with a bone with some of that stuff. I say, okay, well, what's really at the core of this thing? Try and pattern recognize and go, okay, here's like the three things that are happening in your hiring process. Not enough people are applying. Not enough people are showing up for interviews, right? Or not enough people are accepting jobs. Those are the byproducts. That's what you see. What's right. The undercurrent? Why is that happening? Then I go ask thousands, tens of thousands of workers in every Facebook group of Kansas City restaurant hiring Facebook group, all of them. What don't you like about the hiring process? I have them on podcasts where we talk about, you know, how shit resumes are and things like that. And the whole process of, you know, interviewing. And then we model that. We say, okay, here's the issues. It's a waste of time. There's no humanity. There's a lack of understanding of the expectations. I take those three concerns and those three concerns and we overlap them. And we did a model where for one of our clients, I think we interviewed about 100 people and I interviewed every one of them. I wanted to touch this process. 88% of people showed up for their interviews, Simon. Flipped that paradigm completely by just doing a handful of little things that nobody in the restaurant has ever thought to do because we just tried to have the leverage game of like, well, I'm a badass restaurant. We're hiring. So you should want to work here.
Right.
That's not the case. It's a buyer's market. It's a buyer's market. They get to pick if, let alone where they want to work.
Yeah. I mean, that just hits me right here. Cause
the dagger, man.
Yeah. I just remember like the last 10 years hiring has just gotten so brutal. And it's like, oh, and then promoting, like I had a point where I couldn't get people to say, I want to be a sous chef.
Yeah. Right.
And when I said, why, they said, what do you mean? Why? That doesn't look good to me. That guy's stressed out. That girl is stressed out. Like, you know, like he's drinking too much. I'm like, oh shit. And so we had this, like, that's when I started to learn about going back and really developing people, really like developing, you know, because I was running restaurants and I said, hey, you need to manage more. You need to manage better. And they'd all look at me and say, yes, chef, I got it. And I go back a week later and like things hadn't changed. And then I was like, oh. I'm not teaching you. I'm not developing you to be a better leader. So you don't know how, right?
That's exactly right.
I mean, it's chronic. I was at a restaurant conference. You got me fired up, Jensen. I love it, man.
Good. Let's go.
Because this is how we
make change happen, you know?
This is the stuff. I was at a restaurant conference this past year, and it was a panel, and I heard the question, what is the biggest problem in managing, in, you know, opening more restaurants? And this one, like, he's like the chief people person, whatever, I don't know, and he says, underdeveloped leaders. And you want to, I was just like, oh, in the gut, I'm like, man. And so it just drives me nuts. It's like, okay, how do we get more people to invest, you know, in their people? I mean,
and looking at them differently, like Simon, we've looked at ourselves as these finite skills, right? And the problem with that is we keep hiring for these skills when we should be hiring and retaining for attributes, right?
Yeah.
You ask anybody, what makes a great employee, a great member of your team? Oh, they're teachable. They're motivated. They're punctual. They're a good communicator. That's amazing. Amazing, right? Then you ask the same people, so what do you base raises and promotions on? Well, they have to be able to prove that they have these skills, that they have the ROI, that they understand the numbers. Okay, so you must do an open book policy and allowing them to understand those numbers to a deep level so that they can show you exactly how that impact. No, we don't share numbers with them. Gotcha. So you are not actually hiring. You are not actually promoting for attributes. For skills. And so Simon Sinek talks about this. If you ever see the clip of Simon Sinek talking about how the Navy SEALs evaluate their team members.
I love this.
They have skills, right? Abilities and trust.
Right.
And of course you want the person of high trust and high capabilities, high skill, top right corner. And you don't want the person in the bottom left corner. But the person who's high skill, low trust is the asshole that nobody wants to work with. That's me. But they're a great performer, mm-hmm. right? And everybody knows who that is on a shift. Like, oh, fuck, so-and-so is working. They're going to be a pain in the ass. But, hey, they're going to win the wine sales competition because they're a badass at taking care of themselves. They eat what they kill. Fine. And so what they'd actually rather have is somebody of a medium performance with high trust, or even a low performer of high trust is better than the high performer of low trust. And that has always stuck out to me that we didn't do that correctly. And I couple that with the Rock Stars and Superstars. And I go, damn, I had it completely backwards. We had it completely backwards. And so we're having to unlearn and then relearn and teach others who now look at restaurants like they're not a great place to work. So how do we do that? And a lot of people who are in a position who are starting to want to be good leaders and investing in their people and themselves don't have enough people around them to turn into good leaders.
Well,
and so I even see a little bit of vitriol from the people who are good actors in our space because they're like, but I am doing things right. Yes, you are going against all the history of our industry and every shit boss and horrible, uncomfortable, inappropriate interview that they've ever done, every unpaid stage where they had to peel potatoes for 9 hours to prove that they had what it took. That's what you're going against. So you have to figure out how to break that cycle before you can even find the people to then invest in. So we're in a long haul here, Simon. Yeah. And I think people are looking for quick answers here, and there's not many.
There's no quick answers. There isn't. You know, it's gonna take time. It takes time to change, man.
Yeah.
You know, I think one of the biggest degradations of like things that have gotten worse in the last 15 years is I look around and I don't see chefs teaching the way they used to. Mm. Right. Like when you came up, when I came up, there was a ton of teaching and somehow it became me and less we, you know, it's like, I was talking to a cook and he's like, my goal for the next 6 months is to become the best cook in the kitchen I'm in. And I was like, how about this? Try to be the third best cook and be the best teacher so that right. your influence expands so yeah. that when you're ready to be a sous chef. When you're ready, like when you are feeling like you're ready to be a sous chef, you're already there. He's like, well, nobody's ever said that to me. I'm like, I'm sure of that. Yeah. I'm sure of that.
I guarantee that is not that's not the norm.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, there's a lot more. It's interesting, too, when I see the teaching that is working at a high level. There's an interesting shift from it being linear in the way that we were taught.
Yeah.
So the place that I see the most long-term benefit is in the amount of sharing of experience that's becoming a part of the curriculum, so to speak. And I see that a lot, especially with more of the QSR, with foods that are culturally relevant to somebody. I'm going to bring my Filipino family's lumpia recipe to the world, and I'm going to do it in this form. Right. And so I'm going to teach you how to make these, but what's going to really stick with people and create that culture and create that environment of learning mm-hmm. is sharing. I'm going to share with you cooking with those with my grandmother for the first time. I'm going to share with you understanding the technique of exactly how to fold them so they don't break in the fryer. I'm going to share that experience with you, which is different than this is how Escoffier did it, so this is how we're going to do it, because this book says so in culinary school, and this is how you make a cordon bleu who nobody will ever give a shit about, because there is no relevance to us as humans. So sharing as kind of the new medium for teaching, that's where I think there's the most upside potential. And it's going to be clumsy and awkward. It's kind of like seeing my kids' math now. I'm like, this math is way harder. Why are they doing all these things instead of just carrying the number over? Because our math was better at small numbers.
Right.
But then I can see these kids do 5x5 numbers way faster than I can. I was like, oh, my math, and that's a that's a metaphor for all of the things. My math only worked for single digit, two digit, maybe three digit, and I'm way faster than them, and their math makes no sense. But when you're doing 5 and 6 and 10 digits, their ability to do math and all things exponentially to us, even though they may struggle with the small finite things, because school just taught us how to be warehouse workers.
Right.
That's where there's a little bit of a difference kind of generationally that we have to overcome. Their thinking may not work for us in the short term as well, but in the long term, their ceiling is way higher than ours ever was.
Yeah. 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 And then they got springs on their feet, right?
Kids these days, damn it. Are they way smarter than us? And they have way more opportunities and options than us.
Wow. They have access to the little boxes in our hands, right?
The world.
Yeah.
When I mentioned the getting to the moon, this thing has more computing power than we did when we got to the moon. That is wild.
Yeah, it is. That is. Man, I just love the fact that we started at hanging with your boys, and we got to go into the moon with our phone.
It feels like that's the chef's journey. Right, yeah. Simon? Like,
yes, sir.
We went all over the universe, literally, in this talk. But it all kind of made sense to us because we've had different shades of the same journey.
It's exactly what I want from this. I want people who are not chefs to listen to this and go,
facts.
Huh, okay, cool. And I've already started to hear from some people I thought I was only going to be talking to chefs and restaurateurs, and I'm actually getting those civilians, as it were, who are going, I had no idea. I'm like, cool. Then I'm doing my job.
The unseasoned people who have no idea what has gone on inside of a kitchen. I'm having a similar experience. As I mentioned, we're doing now podcast production outside of the restaurant industry. So yesterday, for example, we're doing some setup and sound check and lighting checks for one of our shows that's going to be within the barber world. And I was like,
wow,
yeah, I get my hair cut and I've had my barber for, 7 years, and like, it looks pretty good. I like the hard part and lined up and, whatever. But there's such an interesting subculture that very much reminds me of the restaurant industry. It very much reminds me of that entrepreneurial spirit. That expression of self, the way that they're building community, the way that they have kind of created their own vernacular, and the language is unique to them. And I've actually found myself feeling more kinship with them than somebody who's in a suit and tie at the VP level for chain XYZ.
Right.
I was like, oh, wait a minute. I think I might have more to say and more to learn from them than I do going all the way vertically to the top, whatever that means in a restaurant industry. So I'm finding myself kind of spreading across that entrepreneurial, that expressive industry type that's outside of the restaurant industry.
Yeah.
So when you say that you have people that aren't chefs speaking on it, like the skateboarders and the barbers and the tattoo artists and the street artist and the chef and the musician, I think have more in common potentially than somebody who is in a, the shiny tower of the restaurant industry.
Yeah. 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 I makes total sense to me, man. they're the craftspeople, right?
Yeah. They're the creators. They're the innovators, the disruptors, the people who do cool shit. And that is like my whole thing. I mentioned the cool uncle thing. That's always where I'm coming from a place of being like a translator, trying to understand kind of the humans behind anything that we do. And then being that translator for people who think they're speaking the same language, the cool uncle effect, again, my uncle Rick, Rico Suave, was the one that kind of taught me this without even teaching me this, just by being himself. I was like, wait, my parents, my teachers, my doctors told me to eat my vegetables. Worst idea ever. Cool uncle tells me best idea ever. And so I'm always like looking for those kind of those cool uncle translations where you can take something that's meaningful, important, and put that spin on where people go, oh, hell yeah, I'm into that.
Right.
That's kind of the approach.
Yeah.
That's why I love media. You know, yeah. It gives us that platform to do so.
Awesome. Well, I think we just kicked this one out of the park. Thank you. That's just a great conversation. Like I say, I can't thank you enough for coming to play with us.
I can't thank you enough for putting yourself out there, Simon. This matters. You getting out here and being willing to tell stories and put yourself out on the internet for all kinds of people to judge. And what do you mean? You're just a cook. Get back in the fucking kitchen. Like, stay in your lane. No, this is your lane. And we need more people out there telling stories. There are not enough podcasts. People are like, everyone's got a podcast. No, they don't.
Well, everybody's got a podcast that goes 6 episodes and then
that's exactly right. when we do an arc for our clients, it starts with 8 episodes. You have to invest in 8 episodes, because if you do 8 episodes, you're already in the top 2% of podcasts produced all time, because most people aren't willing to kind of build those habits and figure out and work through the clumsiness and make it something that is sustainable. So yeah, it for sure is important for you to kind of get over that 8, 10, 12 episode mark where it starts to kind of build that muscle memory, build that routine for you. Go to the gym 1, 2, 3 times, you're not going to see an impact. You got to go 12, 15, 20, 500 times. Yeah. I should have been going to the gym for 500 episodes instead of doing my episodes. But hey, I feel pretty good about where we're at.
Yeah, but then you couldn't get to talk about cool shit, because I think that's like the best part of this whole thing.
We love swapping stories. We've been doing that in the kitchen since day one. Now we're just using the internet.
I can think of a day where I was sitting on a bar stool and talking to a couple of youngsters, a cook or two and a server or two, and they're like, we'll buy you another drink if you tell us a story. I'm like, okay, I'll tell you another story.
It's currency, right? It's currency. Right. Oh, I love hearing that. That's so true.
But it's also how, I mean, you can get deep right there and go all the way back to cultures, whether it's 50, 100, 200 years back. History is stories, right? It's how cultures were passed down. And I think that is something that is lost. Some of technology takes it away from us. The good news is that you can use technology to give it back.
And a two-way street.
And make it, as you said earlier, exponential, right?
I get told all the time, wife, kids, family, friends, coworkers, God, you tell the same stories. We've all heard that story. I was like, look, the greatest stories ever told will be told forever.
Yes.
So all I'm doing is testing the stories to see which ones are worth telling forever. Yeah. And that's, what we're here to do. And of course, I'll have former sous chefs or coworkers or things reach out years and years later. They go, I get it. I find myself saying what you said again and again and again, or I have my version of it. Now I understand what you were trying to say. Half the time I'm like, that's not what I was trying to say at all, but I'm glad that you you contextualize it and are using it in that way. That's amazing. So yeah, we need to be out here telling those stories, because this is how the history books are written, this way, by telling stories and retelling them. And sometimes they get a little big fish. I'm guilty of that all the time.
Yeah,
but I won't let all the facts get in the way of a great story.
I was talking to somebody who I used to work with recently, and I was like, man, that's amazing. Where'd you learn that? And he laughed. And this is a guy who's got a great belly laugh, right? And I was like, what are you laughing at? He goes, Chef, you fucking told me that.
Many times.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
He's like, you drummed that into my head 15 years ago. I was like, oh, that's great. That's great.
Yep.
So tell us in a few words, because I'm sure there's a lot of words, how do we find you in the world?
Yeah. Well, get onto those social medias at Jensen Cummings. Best way you can follow along with, you know, everything that I'm kind of sharing, some of the new shows that we have coming out, some of the show series that we have in Best Served Podcast. We've been playing around. We're not just doing the kind of the initial podcast, like you and I kind of do an interview style. We started like really looking at ourselves as kind of entertainment. So we have a show called Restaurants and Pop Culture, where we did episode by episode reviews of The Bear, and then kind of did, you know, our favorite chefs in movie history, and kind of just exploring chef and restaurant culture in film, TV, you know, all those pop culture kind of platforms. Nice. So that was a ton of fun. We're doing some like breaking news, kind of news roundup type stuff as well. We got business centered things. So we kind of have a lot of different story arcs that we're doing, stuff outside the industry, but we've already had a lot of restaurant people be like, yeah, I love going to the barbershop. Like those are like so much fun and best stories. And like those guys are cool shit. So we're already seeing kind of this subculture within the subculture finding its way out. But at Chef, or at Chef, you hear that? Freudian slip. At Jensen Cummings, best place. And then you can kind of find your way to all the other content. But reach out to me. Ryan Reynolds said this, and I always quote this. He said that I'm weirdly available. And I always try to be that. I'm weirdly available. Because too many people think, oh, no, he's here. He's at this level. He's doing all these things. They'll never get back to me. I make a point to get back to everyone. One of the attributes that I hold in the highest regard is rapid response. This is something in restaurant industry we really need to take seriously. Too often we're like, I'm too busy. I'm too busy. I'm too busy. And we don't communicate and interact and get back to people. And we especially don't do that with people that we're supposed to have relationships with, be it your vendors, your guests, your employees. So send me a DM, test me, send me a DM. I guarantee I'll get back to you, you know, send you some other content, answer a question about if you should start doing stages at Michelin star restaurants, a question that I answered a couple days ago from a cook in Indiana who was just reached out, and I'm working a corporate job, but I want to get into Michelin. Should I just start staging while I'm doing my corporate job? Yeah, you should do that. That's where you want to be. Then you'll learn if it is or is not for you. That's great.
Well, you on this podcast is testament to the reaching out, because I thought I'm going to reach out to that guy, and you did not.
You DM me on LinkedIn. Yeah, let's go. We're here.
Yeah.
3 weeks later, whatever it is.
Awesome. Once again, thank you so much. I can't tell you how fun this has been, and enlightening as well. So until next time, this is Chef Journeys, and keep playing with us, and we'll all see you soon.